Welcome to Mental Healthy, where we share the stories and expertise of professionals working diligently in the field of mental health. I'm your host today, Dr. Kenya Knapp. Well, welcome everyone to the Mental Healthy Podcast. I'm glad to have you with us today. I'm excited to have our guest today, Dr. Kevin Hull, who works with me here at Liberty University. He's a really creative guy. Not only is he a mental health counselor, but he's also a registered play therapist. One of the cool things, he's such a creative fella. He has a new application for play therapy. So first off, Kevin, welcome to the program. I'm glad to have you with me today.
Well, thank you, Kenyon. It is great to be with you, and I'm really happy to be a part of this.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're a creative guy, and you come up with this new application. Why don't you describe for the listeners, well, I guess I'm getting ahead of myself. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background? I mentioned you were a registered play therapist, but tell the listeners a little bit about your background, and then we'll get into the subject matter here.
Well, great. I had the privilege of being raised in a Christian home, and my parents worked in Christian ministry my whole life, and so they were part of a children's, it was called Children's Bible Mission, and they ran several camps throughout the United States, and then later in their life, they were directors of a homeless mission here in Lakeland, Florida, for about 15 years. So my formative years were all about watching my parents serve and minister to people, and that led, that was a really strong influence on me choosing to be a counselor and work with people. And so most of my work has been centered around children, adolescents, young adults, and families. And I've worked with autism for the last 20 to 23 years. And so early in my clinical work, I was exposed to children with severe emotional problems and really traumatic experiences that they had suffered. And so I've always been a playful person. I've never stopped playing. That's what got me in trouble in school. And so I'm one of those guys that I can make a game out of anything. And that served me well in my early clinical work because for those of you who have worked in community mental health, there isn't a lot of money, there's not a lot of resources, and you better be creative. So When I found out that there was actually this thing called play therapy, you know, to me, it was like, well, of course, you know, but I was thrilled that there was actually research on this, that it was a clinical approach, and so it was a match made in heaven for me, and that was instrumental in my work with children on the autism spectrum and helping parents to adopt play as a pathway to understanding their children and rebuilding those emotional attachments through play and strengthening those bonds. I'm also that annoying guy who believes that anything is possible. I don't know which of my ancestors I get this from. I'm just very positive. I dare to dream. And so, you know, I'm that guy in a school staffing who, you know, the school's ready to kick the kid out. And I'm like, you know what? I see something here. I think we should give him another chance. I think this is possible.
And it sounds like part of it's from your background. You've been raised around kids who've been through difficult circumstances, and you've seen how some people can turn it around and succeed in life, I guess.
Yeah, my parents, they had a rehabilitation program with the homeless, and it was a six-month program. And during that 6 months, there was job training. There was, of course, spiritual nourishment and biblical-based teaching. And then there was the pathway to independent living. And so they, twice a week, had the folks on the program were in our home for dinner. And so there was a real fostering of this relationship-based catalyst, which, as we know, the Therapeutic Alliance and neuroscience continues to support this. Last week, I was at the National Play Therapy Conference, and Bruce Perry was the keynote speaker. And so, just again, the latest research from neuroscience just confirms this idea of, you know, two people's brains co-regulated is an incredibly powerful healing agent, and also for the developmental process.
You know, I've read some of your articles recently, and you've talked about about regulating brains and things like that. That with young children, there's things they have in common sometimes. Like there's apparently from your article I read, there's millions of children that are without parents sometimes because of life circumstances, and you've started to address the needs of those kids by helping the parents. Give the listeners a feel for how you're helping these kids.
I call it the Play in Prison Project, and this was born back in 2018. I was working with a family, and there was a father was incarcerated, and long story short, the father was released, but there was so much shame and guilt that the reunification of the family and the father just couldn't happen. And so it really bothered me. I've always been a mentor at a local children's home, and Florida, where I reside, has gotten away from residential foster care. So my role in the community, serving the community, had been interrupted. And so I was kind of looking for something to fill that space. And so I knew about 30 minutes from my home was a prison. And one day I just got the idea, there's got to be other dads. There's got to be other parents there who, because they're so racked with shame and guilt, they can't reestablish these relationships. And so I dug into the literature. I talked to as many people as I could, former guards, former inmates, and just looked at the literature. And so what I found was there's high rates of recidivism. So when someone's released, the pathway to not just staying out of prison, but in rebuilding a life is daunting. And these, you know, there's a lot of different numbers thrown around, but basically what I found was basically 7 out of 10 go back into the prison system to some level. And so one of the factors of this high recidivism rate is the community, re-immersing myself into a community, into a home. You know, just imagine you're gone 6 months from your family and you come back. Uh-huh. It's going to feel a little strange. You know, your children, your spouse, even going back to church, where have you been? You know, mm-hmm. And so that was one of the big factors. As of 2016, 2.7 million children in the United States have an incarcerated parent. And so it's estimated that 92% of those incarcerated are fathers. And so this prison in near my community is a male facility. And so I just thought, okay, where do I start? And I called the chaplaincy services, and I talked to the chaplain and told him my idea. I'm a play therapist. I'm a counselor. I'm also a certified group psychotherapist. This is my idea. And he said, I would love to meet with you. Let's see what we can do. And so by 2019, I was established as a volunteer, and I had begun the process of setting up these classes that I do centered around self-development. So self-development can be conceptualized with a few variables such as self-understanding, self-regulation, self-acceptance, and then self-repair. And so play is that integral process within that. To provide that, and I'll expand on that a little later. but it's also with the thrust of being able to rebuild relationships. Think of the average male. Males don't always ask for help. We're made fun of in sitcoms and movies because we don't ask for directions. We don't ask where things are in the grocery store. This is a very male type issue anyway. But now imagine you grew up in a community. By 5 to 7 years old, your parents were either murdered or incarcerated. So you went to live with extended family members. This extended family members, healthy themselves. There's often poverty factors involved. A high percentage of those in prison have spent time in foster care. It's estimated between 60 and 80%. And then a high percentage of those spent more than 5 years in foster care. Mm-hmm. So this community, when I'm released from prison and I have to rebuild my life, this community wasn't necessarily the most nurturing environment in the first place. So this is kind of the framework of what I see through the literature and also in just being now 3 years in the prison setting and hearing the stories. And so that's how it all started. And, I have a small private practice. I have a group practice here in Lakeland. And so, like I said, I do a lot with autism. I've written about that. I work a lot with families, but this just became kind of a personal passion project. I saw a need in my community, especially around the time of, the social justice issues that were going on in our culture, the pandemic as well, and just the overall stress level. I read something a few weeks ago that loneliness has increased astronomically in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting that we're more connected than ever, but yet loneliness has tripled in the last 10 years. And so that's how all of this started.
Well, that's great. I mean, everything you're saying makes sense. I'll say I'm a foster parent myself, and I appreciate all the work you do and all the statistics you were quoting a second ago about prison and history of foster care, that it all makes sense. Now, I tell you, though, I'm just sitting here thinking, how does the average listener hear this? And a lot of people go, man, I thought play therapy is all for these little kids, and they sit there with a sandbox and some toys or whatever. But you're using it with adults in a prison setting and helping it with adults and children with reunification and all that. Give us a little more of a feel, like flesh it out a little bit more. Like, how do you use play therapy with prisoners? Like what does it look like when you're doing this kind of work?
Great question. I have three components of play within this process. And so I use Lego, and then I use expressive art. So drawing when I can, some sort of material like Play-Doh or clay, and then group gameplay. So games, all kinds of different, board games, simple games like checkers, chess, tic-tac-toe. And so those are the three components of play that are embedded within the program. And so when we look at neuroscience helps us see that some of the fundamental pieces of this that come from Stephen Porges, the polyvagal theory, Jacques Panksepp, his studies on play with rats, and I mentioned Bruce Perry, the neurosequential model. We know that people who live in constant stress, and I'll use the term survival mode, they have gaps in their developmental process. So children who live in that, not being sure of, are my needs going to be met or not, and even the base needs like food, clothing, shelter, but up above from that, the emotional need of comfort, the physical needs of touch. Bruce Perry mentioned that for a child to develop healthily and to go to from each developmental level to the next, they need 40 positive interactions a day as an infant. 40, that can be touch, that can be connection, you know, facial connection, that can obviously sleeping, eating, being fed, but touch and voice connection, being talked to. So when we think of how a lot of folks in prison, what their childhoods were like, there's a significant number that didn't have those base physical needs or emotional needs. And so if you can just imagine being, you know, 5 to 7 years old, and then, you know, your life is upside down. You're wondering, constantly wondering, where am I going to get fed? Where am I going to get nurtured? And so there's gaps in the developmental process. And so stress impacts memory. Stress impacts autobiographical memory. So not just memory, but who am I? Who, as I go through my childhood, you know, what my experiences add up to a sense of self. And if I'm spending most of my time in survival mode, that sense of self is not developing. So there's gaps there. Mm-hmm. So the way that this is constructed, the first thing that I start with is the idea of self-regulation. As I look at the literature, you know, being able to be present in the moment and make decisions within the moment and get myself to a space of safety, grounded to the moment, to turn off that sympathetic nervous system, to be able to engage the parts of my brain that are logical, that I can use my analytical thinking, but I can also feel at the same time. And so that's where I begin. And I use toys for this. So I bring in several different toys, and we just take, you know, each, my groups have between 15 and 20 in them at a time. And I run them basically like a semester. So We start in the spring runs, you know, from January to May. And then there's a summer session, and then there's the fall session. So the groups run between 10 to 12 weeks. And so the toys are used as a pathway to self-regulation. So using that toy as a representation to how does this toy, how is it meaningful to me? It might be a matchbox car. It might be a wrestling figure. And so it gets the men thinking about this object that then I use that as a way to ground to the moment. And then we go over breathing techniques. We go over body relaxation. We go over just what does it feel like to not have your brain telling you you're not safe. And then they're able to tell a story through the toy that they've chosen as it relates to maybe something they wanted to be when they grew up. I'll give you an example. This was a couple weeks ago. I used Lego for this. And so one of the guys, he took a square piece of Lego, he put four blocks on it, and then he put a Lego minifigure in the middle. And he said, this is a baseball field. And there's home plate, first base, second base, third base, and I'm in the middle. I was the pitcher. I loved baseball when I was a kid. I played in middle school, high school. And I realized just from building this, that part of myself, I have lost that part of me. I got in with the wrong crowd. I didn't listen to my teachers, my family. And I went on this path of self-destruction, and I'm realizing that guy who I was as a pitcher is who I need to be again. And that part of me is still there. How would life change? How would my day-to-day change, even though I'm in prison, if I brought that self forward instead of thinking I'm a failure, instead of thinking, you know. And so that's just one example of how this happens. So from a neuroscience perspective, we all have these layers of self-protection. So the left side of the brain is that analytical judging side, the planning side. And we use that. It's more active when we're in stressful environments because our brain is telling us we're not safe, therefore we have to survive. What play does, play comes in on that right side. The right side of the brain tends to be that creative, spontaneous, kind of processing emotions on that side. And so play comes in with the idea of opening up, getting that right brain active, because we need both. If we're too left brain, we're rigid, as Dan Siegel tells us, where we live in that white knuckling rigid mode. And if we're all right brain, then we're kind of wishy-washy and maybe not making good decisions because we're living reactively, emotionally driven lifestyle. So landing in the middle, well, play has both of these components in it. If you think about building something, mm-hmm. You're freely creating, but you're also following the rules of physics, the rules of gravity, the rules of, you know, how things go together. You're also planning, but you're also expressing yourself too. This is the same thing in drawing, in art activities. So the first step is that self-regulation. And then from there, we move into self-acceptance, telling the story of me. Where was I wounded? Where was I hurt? Not to blame people in my past, but to understand my story and to put thoughts and feelings into words. So I use a feelings wheel. Many of the gentlemen are surprised when they realize that, you know, behind anger is often shame and guilt. And a lot of them, as they tell their story, they realize that very early on in life, they incorporated because no one's paying attention to me because I have these broken attachments. I must not be worthy of love. I must not be valuable. Mm-hmm. And so play, I use Legos for this as well, playing out scenarios from childhood that, you know, what I wish I would have gotten, but then also, where did I get it? Maybe there was a teacher. Maybe there was a neighbor. Maybe there was a coach somewhere in there that filled that space. Mm-hmm. Because I never want my clinical work to be this, you know, blaming or staying in creating a victim mentality. I am very much a strength-based counselor. And so looking for where, even though I went through a difficult situation, what strengths were born out of that. So it's a balanced viewpoint. But because of using Lego and the Lego minifigures, the emotional impact of that story is there's some distance there. That's another piece that play does. I can also create a different outcome based on using the toys. And so there's a narrative piece that emerges. Mm-hmm. So being able to tell, getting grounded to the moment, and then telling the story of me while I'm grounded, and then telling the story of me in this moment moving forward. So that self-acceptance piece also has this expressive art mm-hmm. that I use. So drawing, mapping things out, telling a story through clay or Play-Doh, creating these that I'm able to communicate and understand. And so there's this level of self-understanding. I come to terms with what's happened to me in my past, but I'm also looking at the future and seeing if I look at myself through who I am in this very moment, I'm thinking, I'm feeling, I have the opportunity to help others if I choose to. I'm safe in this moment mm-hmm. and my future, therefore, because of that, there's no shame, there's no guilt, And I can move towards relationship instead of building defenses in case I get hurt. And so as I look at the programs offered in prison, and, you know, here's the frustrating part. Every prison is different. Some of them have a really great volunteer base. There's a lot of good classes. There's a lot of good courses. Many of them don't. They have crisis mental health care. So if you're suicidal, you'll get seen. If you've been on psych meds, you will see a psychiatrist. But there's not a lot of this self-development. There's not a lot of this actual counseling in the form of self-understanding and self-development. And so that's where I'm using this as a pathway to using play in this way. And then the theme there is self-repair. And so going back to these places, using play to tell my story, understand myself. And then there's a social component. There's this relational social component. Again, men, you know, they don't like to ask for help. So what I do is I bring in board games. And some are two-player games, some are four-player games. And so while they're playing the game, they're building these relationships. And it's in the safety of the class. Prison is the most chaotic place I've ever been. I tell people, imagine you're in the airport, but the airport's on fire. That's what prison feels like. Like there's something bad going on, but I don't know what it is. And I'm not really sure, you know, where I'm supposed to go, what I'm supposed to do next. It's just, it's loud.
Yeah.
I had one gentleman just a few weeks ago say to me, he said, you know what I love best about our class? And I said, what? And he said, you speak to us calmly. Your voice is so soothing. We're used to getting yelled at. And or not spoken to at all. And so the gameplay is sort of, again, right brain opening up, and I'm in this connection with other people, but I'm also feeling a little vulnerable. When you engage in gameplay, there's that competitive side that wants to win, but there's also that you're balancing that vulnerability of having to trust a partner or use strategy. And so it's a modeling of relationship.
Yeah, which is the key of everything.
Right. And it's just an amazing process to see. I'm not allowed to take pictures. I'm not allowed to record video at this point. But I can tell you when the defenses come down and the room is filled with laughter and joy and excitement. It's just, I can't describe it, what a joy it is to see that in such a place that's devoid of that. Now, when our group is done, they have to go back out into, you know, and you can see it, but as we start to wrap up, their body language changes. They put their armor back on, so to speak. And there's this, you know, I get into my persona of what I have to do to get through the rest of my day. But within the space of the play, there's this beautiful self-acceptance that's happening. Some of the stories that I'm getting is that, you know, visitation is now something they look forward to in a new way, because, you know, their little kid comes to visit. Previously, it was just they sat at a table, how's school, good. How's, what are you doing on the weekends? Nothing. You know, now I've got men telling me, hey, we grabbed a piece of paper and played table hockey, you know, just with a crumpled piece of paper. And, you know, so they're taking this play. They're writing letters to their kids, but instead of writing a letter, they're drawing pictures. Because the artwork we've done kind of taps into that, you know, that playful side of how can I make make my letter, you know, come alive. And so also some of those difficult relationships I had, this was about a year ago, a gentleman, you know, had his adult children and he's trying to connect with them and wrote them letters. And well, he used feeling words. He wrote a letter in a different way, not just saying he was sorry, but adding dimensions to using that feelings wheel, which we go through in part of the play process, but adding dimensions to his words. And he got a letter from one of his adult daughters, and it was very angry. And he said, "What do I do with this?" And I said, "Well, she took the time to write you back. She was honest in this. What would you like her to know now?" And he said, "I'm not sure." And I said, "Well, today when we do our Lego time, just see if anything comes up." And so he came up to me after class and he said, "I found out what I want to say to her." And I said, "What is it?" He said, when he showed me this little house, and he had built this little house and put some little Lego figures around it. He said, "Rather than me trying to apologize for the past, I want to tell her what I hope for the future. Relationship, seeing my grandchildren, being a part of her life." And so that was an impetus to healing and mending, repairing that ruptured relationship that before the class, he just thought that she'll be mad at me forever. And we know one of the typical things that the male brain does, if it can't control, it tends to shut down and avoid. And so you see this a lot, not just in males, but people with post-traumatic stress, people suffering from depression. There's this avoidance thing because I don't know what to do. And so that's another part of this self-development is instead of building more defenses or hiding, I can move towards, even when there's conflict. I've had men tell me that because many of them work in the prison, so they work in the kitchen, they work in the yard crews, and they need to confront someone or they need to talk to their supervisor about something that isn't going right. And they use the emotional language of "I feel blank, blank, blank because blank, blank, blank." And they realize, and so a lot of them are reporting enhanced relationships with significant others simply by adding emotional language to their communication and how much that's helping them. But it's rooted in, before I understood myself, before I accepted myself, I would just blow up if somebody didn't agree with me because that's the only tool I had. So those are just a few of the examples of where play is used and how it's used, and just a creative way to bring in, you know, self-development in a place that, you know, you really wouldn't think of play. Now, I've worked really hard. If you can imagine going through airport security with a big bag of toys, that's very similar to what I have to do. But I've got a good relationship with the upper level staff. That's one of the first things that I did, meeting with the warden, meeting with the administration. And so I do have some concessions on, once I get something approved, it's easier to bring it in, but it all still has to be looked at. It has to be examined and, you know, go through security. There's about four checkpoints that I go through. So, you know, I tell people it's a lot like flying. You know, it's kind of a pain to go and find your parking space and go through security and all. But once you're checked in and once you're on the plane, you just sit back. And so as a group counselor and as a play therapist, you know, seeing this work is just really incredible.
Well, it sounds like it, and you know, and you blend the two, which is really neat. I mean, like, you've been giving great examples of how it repairs and things like that, and how they generalize the skills they get. I'm actually reading an article right now that you wrote in December of 2021 that's in the Play Therapy magazine. You mentioned using discussion groups. So just from a structural standpoint, you work with them doing play therapy, I guess, individually, but then you come together and process things in a group. So you go from being the right brain, left brain of letting them do play therapy, but then you process it, it sounds like?
Yes. This comes from the ecosystemic model of play therapy, the theoretical approach from Kevin O'Connor, and the integrative play therapy approach. So it's structured, and processing is an important piece. Now, if someone doesn't want to share, I never force them to. I believe that the power of play is that, you know, you can find meaning in it, whether you voice it or not. However, the processing as a group is enhanced by, you know, when I hear my peer share something that they were struggling with and they this insight that they had, it may very well be that I can adopt that insight as well. And then I share my insight, and then, you know, that can help them also. So the processing time is in that group setting. You know, I'll, before we do it, we'll kind of, you know, we'll do some relaxation. Let's do some box breathing, get our bodies relaxed. Who'd like to share, you know, what came up for you today, or what insights that you had, or, you know, the concept of self-forgiveness is really, really challenging. Uh-huh. And, you know, any counselor who's done counseling, it's interesting to me, self-forgiveness is a component in almost every counseling scenario.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not a lot written about it. There's not a lot of, you know, how do you do it? Mm-hmm. So that's another one of the therapeutic powers of play, is that through that self-examination and self-understanding, I can come to terms with things in my past. And so that processing is part of that. And also, it kicks down the walls of shame when, you know, I'm finding that play makes it okay for me to put words to this. I express myself through what I've built or what I've drawn.
Uh-huh.
And then it's an exercise in presenting myself to the world around me. And that's risky. But if you think about, when you get out, you have to go meet your probation officer. You have to go pay your fine. You have to go to interview for jobs, and hopefully I can find a job. And then I have to integrate into that work community. And then I go back home to my kids who haven't seen me in 4 years or 10 years.
Uh-huh.
And my significant other, who may or may not still be there when I get back, I'm trying to rebuild. I'm establishing my place. My place as a man in community. Well, if I've already practiced, hey, this is me. This is what I made. This is what I think. This is, you know, mm-hmm. And it's an affirmed. My group hears me. My group acknowledges me. You know, the counselor acknowledges me. That's all a picture of what they're going to be doing as they rebuild their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so that processing piece is really important. Even after the gameplay, you know, what emotions came up for you during this? What did you feel? You know, one of the things that's being removed from childhood today is rough and tumble play.
Uh-huh.
In the feminization, especially in our boys, the feminization of our culture is being seen through, you know, preschool children don't touch each other. We don't wrestle. We don't, you know, we don't help each other climb. You have your personal bubble. As children get into elementary school, you can't, don't push, you know, there's no, this rough and tumble play. And yet it's part of our brain structure. Animals do it, you know, it's part of this process. So what often comes out in gameplay is this, it's a safe space for this rough and tumble play, you know, maybe sarcastic comments, or, you know, when I play a game with someone, even just tossing a ball back and forth, there's a level of trust that has to be built, but there's some tension there. Like, you might hurt me by throwing the ball too hard, but I'm ready. But, oh no, you just tossed it nice. Okay, well, I can pretend like I'm going to whip it at you. Mm-hmm. But, okay, I'll just toss it, you know, nice. And so there's space for that within this. And so a lot of the men are telling me, you know, I know how to play with my children now. I can see, you know, I can't wait to see them again. I can't wait to show them what I know, because, you know, for a lot of these guys, play was over when they were kids. You know, by 8 years old, there was no more play. It was survival. It was, you know, taking care of incapacitated parents. Being in foster care, moved from foster care to foster care, placement. So,
yeah,
really important piece.
Yeah, I totally get that. It makes perfect sense what you're saying. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, you've given a great description of it and what it looks like and the theoretical approach. What future plans or dreams do you have for this approach? I mean, this sounds really innovative to me. What ideas do you have for this?
Well, my passion is to be able to get longitudinal research. So to be able to go to the next step with this, gather data, what parts of this program are useful? How does it enhance, you know, is it useful for self-development? I can see that it is, but actually putting some numbers to it, getting some qualitative data, from the lived experiences of group members, and then longitudinal research, you know, 6 months out of the program, a year out of the program, a year after being released, what still sticks with you? What did you take with you? How did this help? And so I'm currently working with the Florida Department of Justice, with their research board. And I've got a proposal submitted, and so that will be the next step. My ultimate long-term goal is to get a grant and then create a pilot program so that other practitioners, other play therapists, group counselors can implement this in other facilities. And so obviously that's going to keep me busy for quite a while, but that's the future for this. So,
well, that's great. You've got vision there. So you got that plan, and then you're going to get it approved by the Florida Department of Corrections. And you got this great article that I read from the Play Therapy Magazine from December 2021. Do you have any other plans to publish anything related to this anywhere?
Absolutely. My overall vision is just to bring it to people's awareness. I think with where our culture is and the climate of our country, we as counselors, we carry the light. I mean, especially those of us who are Christian counselors, we have the answers for what ails our fellow folks. And we have the tools. And so, you know, currently I am doing this just as a volunteer. And, you know, I'm approved within the facility that I'm working in to do what I do. But, you know, to really show other practitioners, and it doesn't have to be in the prison. Think of the poverty-stricken areas of our communities. Think of the single parents. Think of the the foster care population, you know, and just the idea of, hey, wait a minute, I could take a few hours of an afternoon once a month or every couple weeks and just go into this space and bring the tools that I have with what I know, and I could start to make a difference, and I could plug that in. And so the Play Therapy magazine article was a good first step. My next, you know, goal will be collect some data, some survey data, some qualitative measures, and then, you know, approach some journals, and just that'll be the next level. And then I'm presenting at some conferences in the future, so ACA and AGPA, the American Group Psychotherapy Association. I just presented at the National Play Therapy Conference. And so, yeah, just kind of spreading the word. And everywhere I go, and you know, to my knowledge, I'm the only person, I'm the only person using play therapy in the prison setting. There's been studies done about it, you know, a short study here and there, but nothing that I know of that's ongoing. And so I really, it's so well received wherever I go. I really think that if people saw a plan for how to do this, you know, that they'd be receptive to giving it a try.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, you're the only person I know of that does play therapy in prisons. And it certainly sounds innovative and creative and unique.
I tell my students, you know, the working in counseling is the greatest field in the world because we get to bring who we are. We get to express ourselves through our work. And I believe that life should be fun. I'm not afraid to work hard, but I can have fun while I do it. And so I've never lost that vision. And I believe in that, and God's given me the pathway to be able to do that. So I'm really grateful for this opportunity to talk about it.
Well, I appreciate you coming and sharing about it. And we are getting about at that time to wrap up, but I always like to ask guests, you know, is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you'd like to share with the listeners? So let's end on that. And let me also ask you too, if there's a listener who's going, man, this is so cool, this guy is like really creative, I want to work with this somehow, is there any way people could communicate with you? Is there a website or an email you might want to share?
Absolutely. My email is KB, as in boy, Hull, H-U-L-L, at liberty.edu.
Okay.
And I'm happy to share research articles. I'm happy to point people in the right direction and just dialogue about how this could be useful.
Final thought? Yeah.
Yeah. A final thing that I'd like to share is just, you know, it reminds me very much of, you know, Jesus's words where he said, you know, if you do this for the least of these, you've done this unto me. And, you know, I have a private practice. People come to me. They find me, they travel there, they, you know, but I'm also of that mindset that we as counselors play a role in advocacy and also in our communities for the people that can't come to us, for the folks that are limited either because of resources, logistics, or whatever. And so I think, you know, as our culture continues to just be starved for what we can provide, I just would love to challenge folks to think about, you know, where they can plug into their communities and make a difference.
Absolutely. Well, that's a great word to end on. I really appreciate your time today, Dr. Hull, Kevin. And
yeah, thanks, Kenyon. I appreciate it. You're doing a great work with this podcast, and
well,
I just love doing this and having this opportunity.
Well, I'm grateful to have people like you come on here and share unique ways of helping people, and this certainly is one. So thanks for your time, and thank you, listeners, for listening in on the podcast today, Mental Healthy Podcast. And I hope you join us next time when we share another interesting story, interesting approach to therapy, and give you some ideas and inspiration on how you can help people. So thanks so much. You all have a good day. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Mental Healthy. Please be sure to subscribe for more episodes and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. You can find this podcast on all your favorite podcast platforms. We hope you join us next time for more on Mental Healthy.
Music for this podcast is licensed under Creative Commons by Excel Music Publishing at freemusicpublicdomain.com.